to today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, December 4th. I'm your reader, Wanda, and here is our first story. 8 months of working from home take toll on employees, employers alike. Childcare policies among challenges of remote work. Working at her kitchen table, Katie Curtis noticed a conspicuous silence from her toddler, a silence too perfect for an active 2-year-old boy, after he wandered into another room. He took a big chomp out of a piece of candle, Curtis said. He had a handful of wax in his mouth and was like, "Oh my gosh." On another occasion this past spring, she looked over to see her son drinking from the bowl of water meant for their cat. He was lapping it up like an animal and saying, "Oh, that's so yummy," recalled Curtis, Chief Development Officer at Foundation 2, the not-for-profit human services agency. How much worse can it get? Your kid is drinking out of the animal dish. Curtis is not the only one to juggle situations like these. Over the past 8-plus months, employers and employees alike have faced myriad challenges as much of the workforce remains working from home because of the coronavirus pandemic. Mary Noonan, a sociologist at the University of Iowa, has extensively researched the impact of employees working from home. She said the effects varies based on whether someone is a parent, and if so, the children's ages. Are they under the age of 12, where they need a fair amount of supervision, Noonan said during the Gazette's Iowa Ideas 2020 conference in October? Or are they teenagers where they prefer for you to leave them alone? At the same time, the temporary closing of many daycare centers and schools during the pandemic means many of those children, like Curtis's son, often can be in the same room as their parents when they're working. Working from home with children is an entirely different beast than working from home without children, Noonan said. They fear that they're kind of slipping behind at work, but they also feel guilty because they're putting their children in front of screens to try to get work done. Curtis has wrestled with the balance between her son's screen time and her lost productivity. I play this game of, okay, if he can have a half hour of screen time right now when I'm in this meeting, then we'll turn it off at this other time, Curtis said. That was a constant battle of how much screen time was appropriate for a kid that little. Noonan said the parenting while working trend has disproportionately affected women in the workplace. We see that both men and women are doing more, spending more time helping kids with homework. They're spending more time supervising their children, and they're doing some more housework, Noonan said. But the shift definitively increased more for women than for men. It appears COVID has exacerbated the gender inequality in the division of work at home. The lack of social exposure also can more negatively affect women than men, Noonan said. FaceTime, I think, is a huge thing, especially for women, Noonan said. Women feel that sometimes at the office they have to do more than men to prove their worth. And so researchers have found that telecommuting, even though it has a lot of great benefits, can actually hurt women more than men if they don't have that face time. For those without children, Noonan is said working remotely can free up a substantial amount of time. It has the potential of giving the employee more time for leisure or sleep. While many remote workers may appreciate the flexibility of working from home, Noonan's research before the pandemic showed telecommuting can increase the amount of time people spend working. More telecommuters, based on nationally representative data, are people that put in 40 hours at the office, Noonan said. But when they telecommute in the evening, They're doing more work maybe after the kids go to bed. She recommended workers set clear boundaries to avoid overworking. As employees face these issues, including dealing with childcare, many have been leaving the labor force. Iowa's civilian labor force shrunk by almost 120,000 people between February and October, according to data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. The labor force participation rate in Iowa dipped from 65.6% in August, its lowest mark since 1985. Since then, it's risen to 65.8%. Along with the shrinking workforce, employers have also faced several challenges from a human resources perspective. Much of what we've built up for policies, both in terms of internal company policies, as well as our regulatory structure, from a legal standpoint, is really still based around a Monday through Friday 8-to-5 work week where you are physically in an office, said Jason Glass, president of Iowa's Society for Human Resource Management at the Gazette's Iowa Ideas 2020 conference. That's why many companies have been reluctant to change to a work-from-home model before the pandemic, despite the viability of video conferencing technology such as Zoom, Skype, and Microsoft Teams, Glass said. One example of the policy hurdles relates to paid time off. What's actually defined as hours that you're not in the office is a little more complicated in a work-from-home setting. If I'm juggling multiple things in the home with my kids or with my housework and these kinds of things, how do I measure my time? Glass said. Compensation for work-related injuries gives HR managers another challenge. Employers' liability for injuries while working from home is not clear. What happens if I have a repetitive motion injury when I'm working from home? Glass said. Or even something as simple as I trip over my dog when I get up from my chair. I was performing work. Is that now a safety work comp issue? It also necessitates a lot more work for managers on how to evaluate employees when it's time for promotions, Glass said, because managers can't rely on in-person observations. Glass sees working from home creating opportunities for employers, though. Now, an Iowa company potentially could go through the hiring process with someone who's sitting on a beach in California. Sometimes it can be a challenge to get people from other areas of the country to move to Iowa because of their perceptions of what Iowa is, Glass said. It's a tough hurdle to get over. This opens up some opportunities for us to tap some of that talent that we may not have been able to get to move here physically in the past. There's a catch to that, though. It also means that every other competitor can pull my people, Glass said. As companies adjust to onboard employees via video conferencing, Glass said companies need to be more intentional about the process. Even if we say, let's have a team lunch where we're all on Zoom and have some social time, that doesn't feel the same as when you do it in the office, Glass said. In some cases, it can even feel forced. Some people have gotten creative to replace the social interaction that would usually occur on a daily basis in the office. Curtis, the Foundation 2 development officer, said she has been playing a lot of the Jackbox games that allow people to play from different locations. It's really great because you get to spend time with people in different states that maybe you wouldn't typically get to hang out with, Curtis said. In the meantime, Curtis hasn't needed to stop her son, now 3 years old, from eating candles or licking cat bowls. Now that he's back in school, we've had so much more of a normal routine, Curtis said. Holiday festivities markets begin this weekend in Nubo, Czech Village in Cedar Rapids. Get a big dose of holiday spirit this weekend in the new Bohemia and Czech Village districts. Events begin Friday night with the Czech Village Association's virtual tree lighting ceremony at 6:30 p.m., streaming on Facebook Live at facebook.com/deckthedistrict. Other activities include Santa Letters Mailbox by the Big Cherry at the Cherry Building's 11th Avenue Southeast entrance. Drop off through December 13th for reply from the North Pole. National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library, 1400 Inspiration Place Southwest. Drive-through cookie walk, 10 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. Saturday. Old World Market, vendors online through December 24th. store.ncsml.org. Free museum gallery admission Saturday and Sunday. Museum store open for in-person shopping. Cherry Building, 325 10th Avenue Southeast. Very Cherry Holiday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday. Iowa Ceramic Center and Glass Studios Very Cherry Gallery Exhibition, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday and Sunday. Nubo Market, 1100 3rd Street Southeast. Black-owned business holiday market, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday. Virtual Santa storytelling, noon to 2 p.m. Sunday this week and every Sunday in December. CSPS Hall, 1103 3rd Street Southeast. View galleries online at CSPSHALL.org. Retail promotions throughout the district. Coronavirus canceled SantaCop, but Cedar Rapids police still found a way to make a difference. Instead of taking children shopping for winter gear, officers joined Coats for Kids effort. If 2020 were a typical year, officers with the Cedar Rapids Police Department would be preparing for their annual Santa Cop event, during which officers take children from about 100 families shopping for winter items and a little something fun. The program is sponsored by the Cedar Rapids Police Protective Charity, which pays for the items via donations, and officers give their time to help children shop for needed cold weather items, including coats, snow boots, gloves, and winter hats. SantaCop started about 17 years ago with a few officers who saw a need and funded the shopping spree themselves, said Charity Hansel, Cedar Rapids mental health officer. Now the event has grown to include two events, one during the holiday season and another Shop with a Cop event at the end of summer for back-to-school supplies, with dozens of officers and hundreds of kids. Unfortunately, 2020 has not been a typical year. Because of the pandemic, the department called off SantaCop. Hansel recently spoke with the Gazette about how officers still found a way to get winter goods to local kids. Question: can you talk about the decision to call off the SantaCop event? Answer: we absolutely love doing the SantaCop event. We love seeing the children and we want to develop those relationships. That was the whole point of the program. But at the same time, we know because of COVID that we couldn't. It just wasn't safe. We didn't want to put officers in that environment We didn't want to put the kids and their families in that environment, and we didn't want to put the employees at Target at risk. So we voted unanimously to find some other way to contribute. What did you end up doing? That's the question. Answer. At about the same time that we, the board, decided that we couldn't do the Santa Cop program, KCRG was doing their Coats for Kids event. So I reached out to them to see if there was a way we could help with that program. The Cedar Rapids Police Protective Charity had $10,000 earmarked for the Santa Cop event. So we thought maybe we could donate that money to Coats for Kids. The catch was that I wanted to make sure our donations went to local kids and the Coats for Kids events reaches something like 19 counties on the eastern side of Iowa. But since we were planning to donate such a substantial amount, we were able to designate that the coats we purchased stayed local. And I think the event ended up raising more than $40,000 in total, which is great. Question. About how many coats were purchased with the Cedar Rapids Police Department Protective Charity Funds? Answer. We were able to purchase 500 coats, but we didn't want to just give the money and be done. We wanted to be involved. So when the coats were ordered and delivered, officers helped tag and bag all of the coats, and then they helped deliver the coats to the Salvation Army and a couple other places, and then the other officers helped staff those places when the coats were given out. It was kind of a drive-through type situation so we could minimize contact with the families, but still make sure we could get coats to the kids, and we ended up with some leftover coats. Question, what will you do with the leftover coats? Answer. So we have about 100, maybe a few more, coats left, and they will be brought over to the police department in the next few days. We know that there are still kids out there that need coats, and so we want the community to know that anyone who still needs a coat for their child to please contact me directly here at 319-286-5406. And I will make sure that a coat gets delivered to that child. Question, do you have any other thoughts about this year's adaptation? Answer, there were pluses and minuses to the decision to not do Santa Cop. A plus is that we reached a lot more kids in 2020 by joining with Coats for Kids, but we would much rather have that personal contact if we could. We knew it was going to be different, but we really wanted to make sure that families knew that we still care about them, and we know that there's a need, and we want to help with that. And it was hard on us to miss out on that contact with the kids. It's a big deal for us to be around kids and to form those relationships, so it stinks that we missed that opportunity. Not once this year, but twice. The department's back-to-school shopping event was also canceled due to COVID. But we're going to keep doing what we do. We're going to keep raising money, and we're going to keep reaching out to the kids. And hopefully, we'll return back to some sort of normalcy in time for next fall. And that's what we're really praying for. Still waiting for FEMA check after derecho. New loan fund may help. Linn County organizations collaborate to help provide relief. With winter closing in and federal aid and insurance payments backlogged for some, community organizations have teamed up to establish a new revolving loan fund to help Linn County homeowners repair homes damaged in the August 10th derecho. The program, which also allows qualifying homeowners to apply for loans of up to $15,000, is intended to help plug funding gaps that some homeowners have reported as a barrier to recovery, having to wait for insurance payments or assistance from the Federal Emergency Management Agency to fix their homes. Cedar Rapids Bank and Trust contributed $100,000 to establish the fund, according to a news release. The Greater Cedar Rapids Community Foundation and United Way of East Central Iowa each contribute $50,000, totaling $200,000 available for loans. The fund is part of the Providing Assistance to Community Homeowners program, which is a partnership of funders and nonprofit organizations that recently has started making minor home repairs with volunteer labor on homes of qualifying homeowners. Many of our neighbors need the dollars now to be able to get necessary home repairs started, Kristen Roberts, the President and Chief Executive Officer of United Way of East Central Iowa, said in a statement. We know this revolving loan fund will allow our community members to start critical work before winter arrives in full force. Patch participants may borrow from the revolving loan fund until their benefits arrive, then pay back the fund once they receive funding from FEMA or their insurance companies. According to Sharon Carr, the FEMA Joint Information Center manager, the federal agency has approved applications for 1,769 Linn County residents to receive $4.67 million in FEMA Housing Assistance Program funds, comprising most of the $7.42 million the FEMA program has awarded to Iowans residing in counties eligible for assistance. She said that these dollars cover repairs, replacement, and rental of for approved applicants. FEMA by law cannot duplicate payments from other sources, such as insurance companies. Additionally, Carr said $2.48 million in other needs assistance funds have been granted to 1,149 Linn County residents to help with necessary expenses. And as of November 26, she said, the Small Business Administration had awarded to 807 Iowans $24.9 million in loans for home repairs. Carr said after individuals register for assistance, they may reach out to FEMA to update information such as contact phone numbers, their address, any insurance settlements, or additional damage they may have found by calling 1-800-621-3362 or visiting disasterassistance.gov. FEMA funding intends to make homes habitable, but not necessarily restore the property back to its original condition before the derecho, Carr said. The Iowa Insurance Division reported that as of November 2nd, the most recent data available, of the more than 200,000 claims reported across Iowa from the derecho, nearly 160,000 claims amounting to more than $1.6 billion had been paid. More than half of those claims, a total of 103,884, were from homeowners insurance. Companies had paid out $876.8 million to cover 81,472 claims. Some patch program loans have for expenses not covered by insurance or FEMA may be forgivable, provide a financial boost to qualifying homeowners affected by the derecho, according to the news release. Qualifying homeowners apply for up to $15,000 each from the fund, which the Housing Fund for Linn County and the Neighborhood Finance Corporation administer. The Community Foundation's Disaster Recovery Fund contributed a grant to fund an administrator overseeing the program. True North Associates will help PATCH participants navigate their insurance and FEMA claims, payments, and questions according to the release. This is a wonderful example of how collaboration is critical after a disaster, Les Garner, president and CEO of the Community Foundation, said in a statement. So many organizations have come together to respond, and that is what makes this such a great community. To access the PATCH program and the revolving loan fund, homeowners may contact Waypoint at 319-366-7999. Two law enforcement veterans to lead University of Iowa Public Safety for now. Interim directors to take charge after delayed retirement of Scott Beckner. University of Iowa Department of Public Safety Director Scott Beckner announced his retirement in February. He originally planned to leave the university and move to Florida in June, but the coronavirus pandemic changed his plans. Beckner instead decided to stay on through the end of the fall semester. There won't be another delay in Beckner's plans to retire. The university announced in November that Beckner will indeed retire this month. He will stay on through December 31st to help with the transition. After his departure, two interim directors will lead UI Public Safety. UI Police Chief Lucy Wiederhoff and Captain Mark Bullock. Wiederhoff and Bullock will serve as co-directors under a permanent public safety director is in place. I look forward to working with Chief Wiederholt and Captain Bullock during the transition, and am confident the department will continue to run smoothly under their leadership, said Rod Larnitz, Senior Vice President of Finance and Operations. Wiederholt has served in nearly every role within public safety since being hired as a security guard in 1985. She worked as a dispatcher and a police officer trainee before becoming a police officer with the department in 1988. From there, Wiederholt served as sergeant, detective sergeant, lieutenant, and captain before being promoted to chief in January 2010. Even serving as interim director is familiar to Wiederhoff, who stepped into the role in 2016 when former public safety director Chuck Green retired. Bullock joined the UI Department of Public Safety in 2014 and quickly climbed the ranks. He was promoted to sergeant in 2015 and captain later that year. He previously worked for the Memphis, Tennessee Police Department for 6 years and was awarded that department's Medal of Honor. Later this month, Bullock will compete in the UI Tippy College of Business Executive MBA program. He also served as class president of Northwestern University's School of Police Staff and Command. The university said it will conduct a national search for a new public safety director during the spring semester. Officials have not yet said when they hope to have a new director in place. You are listening to the Cedar Rapids Gazette, IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Wanda. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Shirley Ann Dornbos, D OORNBOS 85 passed away December 2nd because of complications of COVID-19. She put up a courageous fight for several weeks in the ICU before going into palliative care at UIHC, where she passed away peacefully. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 6:30 p.m. Saturday, December 5th, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Iowa City, where visitation will be held from 2 to 4 p.m. Friday, December 4th. Please respect the wearing of masks and social distancing guidelines. The Mass will be live streamed for those who are not able to attend. Details and instructions on how to watch the service may be found on Shirley's tribute wall at www.lensingfuneralhome.com. Instead of flowers, the family asks that you send memorial donations to St. Mary's Catholic Church in Iowa City. Private entombment will be held at Memory Gardens in the mausoleum. Shirley was born August 31st, 1935, in Muscatine, Iowa, to Hubert Henry, and Emma Mary Kern. She grew up in Muscatine in Iowa City, where she graduated from St. Mary's High School in 1953. She went on to attend college at Mercy Hospital School of Nursing, graduated in 1956 with a degree in nursing. She married William Crippen on September 10, 1956, in Iowa City, and had six children before they later divorced. Shirley began her nursing career in Iowa City, which turned out to be nothing but successful. She was a devoted registered nurse for 34 years, starting at Mercy Hospital, where she worked for 13 years as a labor and delivery nurse. She then worked for UIHC for the remaining 21 years of her career in the research center, ultimately focusing on brain tumor research through the NIH. She retired in 1995. Shirley was set up on a blind date with John Fred Dornbos, an oncologist who had just moved to Iowa City and had begun working at UIHC. The couple went on to get married on November 21, 1986, in Iowa City, and enjoyed 32 memorable and loving years together before he passed away suddenly in 2018. They eventually moved into an apartment at Grand Living in Bridgewater, where she made many friends who she adored dearly. Shirley was an avid Hawkeye fan and loved to host Hawkeye parties. She and her beloved husband, Fred, traveled near and far to cheer on the Hawkeyes. She was active in the Hawkeye Club, volunteered for the Mercy Guild, and was a member of the University of Iowa Retiree Association. Shirley was a dedicated member of St. Mary's Catholic Church in Iowa City. Shirley loved to play bridge, do crossword puzzles, needlepoint, play canasta, and had the luck to win at bingo. Above all things that brought her joy, Shirley's family was her greatest joy of all. Any time spent with her children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren meant everything to her. Shirley is survived by her children, Margaret, Peg, Young of Iowa City, Pamela, husband Jim, Overton, Rizzolio of Paradise Valley, Arizona, Michael, wife Karen Crippen of Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Rebecca, husband Tom Paynton of Iowa City, Cynthia, husband Johnny Tigert of Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, Mark, wife Catherine Crippen of Phoenix, Arizona, stepchildren Daniel, wife Mary Beth Dornbos, M.D. of Windsor, Maine, Suzanne, husband David Purbau of Chicago, and William, wife Melanie Dornbos of Columbus, Ohio. Grandchildren, Justin, wife Kelly, Brandon, wife Carrie, Teddy, wife Lauren, Christian, Elizabeth, Kathy, husband Keith, Lauren, Amy, husband Jared, Sarah, spouse Banny, David, Joseph, Joshua, spouse Nick, Matthew, Reed, Julia, Katie, husband Keith, John, wife Katie, Caitlin, Kendra, Taylor, Thomas, Sarah, Destiny, and Amber. 19 great-grandchildren and many extended family members. She was preceded in death by her parents, her husband, siblings Ward, Leroy, Pern, Mary Betty Hoagland, and Hubertine in infancy, and one granddaughter at birth, Molly. Lorraine Edna Trachta, T-R-A-C-H-T-A, 92 of Cedar Rapids, died Wednesday, December 2nd at Emory Place in Robbins. As per the family wishes, private celebration of life services will be held at Brosh Chapel and the Evagrine and the burial in Czech National Cemetery. Lorraine was born February 26, 1928 in Dorchester, Nebraska, the daughter of Albin and Helen Dvorky. She was united in marriage to Donald Trachta on June 24, 1947 in Cedar Rapids. She was a longtime member of Sharon United Methodist Church. Lorraine was an avid quilter, enjoyed traveling, and most of all, spending time with her family. Lorraine is survived by her children, Sandra, husband Peter, Wiersbicki, and Dennis, a wife Lorna Trachta, grandchildren Jonathan, wife Jessica Schultz, Janine, husband Andrew Van Eaton, Danielle, husband Kirk Kolek, great-grandchildren Madeline and Riley Kolek, Bella Van Eaton, and Cooper Schultz. Step-grandsons, Paul, wife Angie, and Andrew Wiesbecki. Two step-great-grandchildren, Jolene and Symphony Wiesbecki, her sister Dolores Trachta, as well as her nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents, her husband Donald, who died on January 8, 2019, and her siblings Richard, wife Doris Dvorky, and Janice, husband Sam Franks, and a brother-in-law, Elmer Trachta. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Hospice of Mercy. Online condolence may be expressed to the family at www.brashchapel.com. Patsy Jane Pat Stone, 75, of Edgewood, Iowa, passed away on Wednesday, December 2nd at her home. Survivors include her husband of 53 years, Carol Stone of Edgewood, her daughter Kimberly, husband Mason Stein of Mount Vernon, her son, Jason Stone, of Sierra Vista, Arizona, one grandson, Tyler Stein, two sisters, Sandy Brown of Walford, and Karen Brehicka of Cedar Rapids, and many nieces and nephews. Online condolences may be sent to www.leonardmullerfh.com. Because of COVID-19 concerns, masks are required at the funeral home. A private graveside service will be held at the Hansel Cemetery in rural Colesburg. Beverly Kanak, K-A-N-A-K, 93, of Marion, passed away on Wednesday, December 2nd at the Scottish Rite Park Health Care Center in Des Moines, Iowa. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, private family services will be held. The service will be live streamed at 1:30 p.m. Saturday, December 5th. The live stream may be accessed on the funeral home website tribute page for Beverly under photos and videos or media. Starting at 1:30 p.m. Saturday, please share a memory of Betty at Beverly at www.murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. A complete obituary will be published in the Saturday and Sunday editions of the Gazette. Harold James Jim LaRue, 94, of rural Oxford, died Wednesday, December 2nd at the Crestview Care Center in West Branch. Private family services will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, December 5th at Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Services. The services will be live streamed for friends and extended family. Please share your support and memories with Jim's family and find a link to the live stream details on his live stream link at www.gayandchia.com under obituaries. This can be viewed anytime during and after the services. Burial with military honors will be held at Memory Garden Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to the Oxford United Methodist Church or the charity of your church. Choice. For a complete obituary to share a thought and memory of condolence, please visit the funeral home website at www.gayandchia.com. John Overman, 56, of Ottumwa, Iowa, died Thursday, November 26. John was born February 14, 1964, in Cedar Rapids, the son of Fred and Bridgian Overman. He graduated from Washington High School and received an engineering degree from Iowa State University. John worked for many years at Cargill in Ottumwa until he retired early for other pursuits. Always skilled at making and fixing things, he spent many years restoring rental properties. He enjoyed following the stock market, often giving tips to those he knew, spending time in the kitchen, where his talent showed from baked goods to cooking, following politics, and spending time outdoors fishing. John will be remembered for his keen mind, great conversation, and gentle spirit. Survivors include his father, Frederick Overman, siblings Joe Overman and Bridget, husband Ted Battistone, and niece Juliet Battistone. He was preceded in death by his mother, Bridgian Overman. A private family mass will be held at a later date. Dorothy A. Zimmerly, 93, of Independence, died on Saturday, November 29th at the Buchanan County Health Center in Independence, Iowa. Dorothy was born on June 10, 1927 in Quasqueton, Iowa, the daughter of Roy and Zoe Smith Manson. She was raised in Quasqueton and was a 1946 graduate of the Quasqueton High School. On September 5, 1957, she married Robert A. Zimmerly of Corinth, Mississippi. Dorothy worked for many years at Microswitch in Independence and Cedar Rapids. She also enjoyed working as a waitress at several cafes in Independence, but spent the longest time serving at the Pinnacan Hotel Cafe. She is survived by her husband of 63 years, Robert Zimmerly. Dorothy is preceded in death by her parents, Roy and Zoe Manson, a sister, Lois Jones, and three brothers, Glenn, Laverne, and Virgil Manson. A graveside service will be held at Mount Hope Cemetery in Independence. The Reef Family Center Funeral Home and Crematory assisted the family with services. To leave an online condolence, please go to www.reeffamilycenter.com under obituaries. Gilbert Billings, of 76, of Delhi, passed away at home on December 2nd, surrounded by his family. Bonin Kemp at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Manchester, is assisting the family. All guests are respectfully required to wear a mask and practice social distancing. Bruce was born October 24, 1944, in Manchester, Iowa, the son of Errol and Flora Billings. After graduating from Maquoketa Valley High School in Delhi in 1962, he served in the U.S. Army Reserves and worked at a pallet factory in Dyersville. Prior Construction in Dubuque, Schindler Construction Pipeline, and the Creamery in Hopkinton. He then went on to work at Bradco in Delhi for 45 years while living and working on the family farm. Additionally, Bruce and his brother owned a bulldozer and built terraces, did custom work and custom baling. On March 23, 1974, Bruce married Emily Anderson at Salem United Methodist Church in Cedar Rapids. Three children were born into this marriage. Bruce enjoyed fishing, working with wood, and was talented at working with metal. He had a fond love of dogs. Those left to cherish his memory are his wife, Emily, of 46 years, of Delhi. Children, Dana, husband, Alan, Spierflage, Spierflage, of Albernat, Deidre, husband, Justin, Dahlblogger, of Waterloo, Darren, wife, Keisha Billings, of Cogan. Eight grandchildren, including Bree, Brent, Blake, Kale, Grayson, Maeve, Bennett, and Logan, and two sisters, Lydia Olafson and Juanita Beam. He was preceded in death by his parents and a brother, William. The family wishes to thank above and beyond for their care of Bruce, as well as the care and prayers of the congregation of the Delhi United Methodist Church. Bruce was a member of the American Legion and attended Delhi UMC. A drive by visitation on the family farm through the workshop, where Bruce spent many of his days, will be from 1 to 3 p.m. Sunday, December 6. Visitation attendees should remain in their cars. Due to COVID-19 restrictions, a private family service will take place. A live stream of the funeral service will be accessed on the funeral home website tribute page for Bruce under photos and videos or media, starting at 10 a.m. Monday. Memorials may be directed to Dollars for Scholars. Online condolences may be left at www.murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. Winter sports are hit and miss in eastern Iowa, from the sports section. Ogden Column, maybe it's time to take another short break. Winter is coming. Maybe. With apologies to Game of Thrones fans, what lies ahead on the sports calendar in eastern Iowa appears to be a little treacherous at best. And this isn't a weather report. Winter sports already have started while fall sports are winding down. Always an exciting and hectic time for sports media everywhere. But there already has been a number of delays, postponements, and cancellations. The 2021 sports world is starting to look a lot like the previous 9 months of 2020, thanks to the ongoing uphill battle with the coronavirus. A lot of area high school teams are on hiatus as classes have gone online. The three Cedar Rapids public schools, as well as Prairie and Linmar, have shut down activities. Marion and Xavier continue to soldier on when they can find an opponent. Iowa City schools, with the exception of Regina, are in the same boat. Check out the Mississippi Valley Conference website, and you'll see a lot of black lines through events, followed by the words in red, postponed or canceled. As the Gazette's KJ Pilcher reported earlier this week, the inaugural Dan Gable Donnybrook Wrestling Tournament scheduled for this weekend at the Extreme Arena in Coralville is canceled, along with Independence's annual two-day event, to name a couple. The college scene isn't any better. The Iowa men and women's basketball teams have started their seasons, but the top-ranked wrestling team hasn't even released a schedule. Ditto Iowa State and Northern Iowa. Mount Mercy is playing basketball games when it can, with no fans, and Kirkwood has nothing scheduled until January, including a volleyball schedule. The American Rivers Conference recently announced its plan to return to competition, also in January. Coe and Luther, along with the other members, are planning a conference-only basketball schedule that will include 9 dates starting January 23rd. The ARC plans a week of makeup games in February, followed by the conference tournament. The ARC wrestling schedule consists of 4 regular season dates that with triangulars at three different sites, also starting January 23rd. The regional tournament is set for February 27th, the NCAA 3 championships March 13th. Volleyball is set to return to the ARC in February. Soccer and football in March. The football schedule will include 4 dates between March 27th and April 17th. The Midwest Conference, of which Cornell is a member, announced Thursday it will not sponsor any league competition or championships for fall or winter sports. The Rams will attempt to start practices in January, with the hope of some type of non-conference competition starting in February. Don't hold your breath. This isn't an exercise in scheduling mayhem, but I feel for athletics directors and sports information directors everywhere. I'm bracing for a very hectic spring, and I wouldn't mind it a bit, Cornell Sports Information Director Carrie Call wrote in an email Thursday. It's stressful in my position, but I can't imagine what the student athletes and coaches are going through. I'm an optimist by nature, and quite frankly, my livelihood kind of depends on games happening, sports teams and individuals doing the things they do best, competing. I have been impressed by how the Iowa High School Athletics Association and the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union were able to hold summer and fall activities, as well as the low number of positive cases inside the Iowa and Iowa State athletics departments. But if we've learned anything about COVID-19 since our introduction last March, it's that we know nothing is predictable. Winter is not just coming, it's upon us. That's why a pause may be in order. Take a break, like many already are doing, or will be doing because of the holidays. And let's take another shot at this in January. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. I'm your reader, Wanda. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.
This is Jim Ralston with an Irish short take from the Book of Iowa Curiosities. Check out them checkers from Dubuque. Don Dwebar, creator and curator of the World of Checkers Museum, which also doubles as his apartment, is the special breed of collector who turns an obsession into a way of life. "I've gone without many meals just so I could buy books on checkers," he told me. "I'm what you call a bibliomaniac. I have over 2,000 checker books before I donated them to the Loris, a private college in Dubuque, and the Cleveland Public Library." While books on checkers are his first passion, or more accurately, his first monomania, he recognizes that they're not necessarily everybody's cup of tea. They're not the kind of book you read for fun, like Little Red Riding Hood. They're about checkers strategy, just descriptions, really, of what we call lines of play, from famous matches with an estimated 500 billion possible situations that could rise in a match. I'm not joking there. There's seemingly no end to checker strategy, nor the books that one could write about it. That's just fine with Dwebar, otherwise known as Mr. Checkers. Lee's Guide to the Game of Checkers was first published in 1897, and I had over 500 copies of that book, representing 127 different editions. Not many collectors would do that. Indeed, it's widely believed that his collection of books on checkers was possibly the largest and most certainly the most complete in the entire world. But Mr. Checker's passion for checkers didn't stop with books. Over the last 30 years, he's filled his tidy apartment with every checker set imaginable, made of everything from wood to bakelite to bone, as well as an impressive variety of checkers memorabilia. A kitchen cabinet, drawers, and even his refrigerator and stove have at one time or another been called into service as the World of Checkers Museum storage and display space. "Not to worry, you little fire marshals in training," Don said. He unplugged the stove and refrigerator first. And the best part is, his home and museum are open to the public for all to enjoy. "It's like the Mona Lisa," Mr. Checker said, of his museum. "You really have to see it to appreciate it. The Mona Lisa should be so lucky as to have a passionate and single-minded caretaker and roommate as Don Dwebar." If you feel like visiting Don and his World of Checkers, call 563-556-1944 or email him at checkers21@hotmail.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.